Thank you. When Don Lipset asked me if I would speak here, he said, talk about culture. And I thought about it for a while and decided the thing, the proper title for a talk on culture is The Nuttiness of the Professional Middle Class. And so that is the title of this talk. Perhaps no single word has been used more often in discussions of culture than the word change. We Americans, for instance, and I'm sure it's true in Canada as well, we seem to have a special penchant for measuring ourselves, for keeping a running account of our opinions on every conceivable subject, from politics to soap flakes, for, you might say, taking the national temperature at regular three-hour intervals. And in all this polling and temperature taking, the one idea that remains constant is the idea of change. Merely from reading the daily papers over the last 30 years, you would have the impression that we have been through more fundamental revolutions. Revolution, of course, being another term in popular use among us. We have been through more fundamental revolutions than the world had seen in the preceding 30 centuries. We are, in short, a people besotted with our courtship of the new. There was once a man, to cite only one and by no means the most important example, named Marshall McLuhan. Do you remember Marshall McLuhan? He was a very brilliant and original man who, like many brilliant and original men, was afflicted with the sinful temptation to be historic and profound. Every century produces a tiny handful of historic thinkers, and McLuhan clearly wished to be one of them. He looked at television and looked at us looking at television and saw that here was something new. Now, television was certainly something new as a technology in itself and as a shaper of new habits of recreation among its audience. No one can deny that. But what Marshall McLuhan claimed to see in the effect of television was not a marked change in public habits. That would have been too modest. But rather a radical change in the very nature of human perception. We were, he said, actually commencing to think differently. What he called the linear conception of reality, the kind that has been produced by reading and traditional logical thinking, was at an end. Thus, not only would we henceforth be spending a good deal of our time in the company of this new technology, we would actually be a new species of people. I must confess to you that I never absolutely understood what was supposed to be meant by linear and non-linear perception. Maybe because, circularly, I was too old and too old-fashioned and so hopelessly mired in the linear myself to be able to grasp it. But now I look around me and see that people are still reading, indeed more of them than ever, and watching television, and they don't seem so very much altered to me. I notice that my children, and especially my grandchildren, who always have the television on, actually pay rather little serious attention to it. TV is a constant hum in their lives, like a noisy neighbor whom one is too polite to tell to say, please shut up. But are my children and grandchildren fundamentally different in the way they perceive? I suspect they could still read the Bible, I hope, although with not too much optimism, that they do now and then, and without hesitation recognize everything human in it, including the way those old-timey people back then used to think about and see the world. McLuhan is perhaps an extreme case, but certainly in many milder forms, we are constantly being invited and just as predictably accepting each new invitation to see ourselves as travelers embarked on some uncharted sea, all alone, without compass or guidance. We have had the sexual revolution, the youth revolution, Norman Mailer's revolution of consciousness, the revolution from producerism into consumerism, the death of nationalism, the death of the family, the transmogrification of the planet into spaceship Earth. I could go on and on. The microchip, all by its minuscule self, will no doubt be held responsible for half a dozen revolutions. And with each of these revolutions comes, inevitably, the birth of a new generation. American society, and again, Canadian society as well, has become a veritable miracle of procreation. It used by common calculation to take 30 years to produce a new generation. We produce at least one every 5 years. How, with the birth rate going down, we do this might once have been the subject for the deepest scientific speculation. But the answer is actually quite simple. For we produce these rapidly accelerating generations, not by conception and birth, but by journalism. And Lord knows there is enough of that. Generations are found by the press and media, you might say, full grown under the mulberry bushes of pop sociology. Now, before I go further, let me just explain that when I say we, I don't mean everybody. I mean we. I mean the educated middle class. Playing around with social change is, after all, a luxury affordable only by people with a little time on their hands. In the end, paradoxically, the one thing that truly does make us different from our forebears is the effect on us of this willingness, this eagerness, indeed, to accept the idea that we are changed. And what is the effect on us that I am referring to? In plain language, it is driving us nuts. Let us examine just a few of the more colorful instances of our nuttiness. In most places on the North American continent, the automobile has become the exclusive means of getting from one place to another. People jump into their cars to go to the nearest corner. If one's battery goes dead or one's carburetor, say, needs adjustment, emergency measures must be taken. Call out the tow truck and the automobile rental man. We have become a nation of the legless. In Beverly Hills, California, I'm told, if someone is seen walking in a residential neighborhood, he is immediately suspected by the police. Yet every morning, and every evening, and sometimes in the middle of the night, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people don special costumes and shoes, and at serious risk to ankles, shins, and spines, not to mention hearts, run miles and miles to nowhere in particular and back again. These same people, or others indistinguishable from them, have suddenly discovered that some foods have more beneficial nutrient properties than others. They have taken to considering and weighing every single thing they put into their mouths. Some fuss about cholesterol, some about fiber, some about additives. There are never fewer than two diet books, for instance, on the New York Times bestseller list. Not all of them, by the way, how to get thin. Some tell you how to eat so you can live forever, as Ernest Van den Hogg will enthusiastically describe to you. And some will tell you how to eat so you can succeed in business. We are routinely issued dire warnings about our habits of intake. Smoking will kill you, overweight will kill you, preservatives will kill you, sugar will kill you. No doubt a million American kids are eagerly waiting to hear that milk will kill you. We are, in short, almost hysterically obsessed with our physical health. You might think that if we were careful enough, we could be immortal. At the same time, cocaine consumption is becoming commonplace, and nowhere more so than among the very group of people who run and anguish over the conspiracy of the American food and tobacco industries against them. As we all know, a critical aspect of our lives nowadays is relationship. I love that word. Some people call it communication, as when someone beating someone else to a pulp is called a failure of communication. In the city where I live, the leading newspaper has a daily column called Relationships. In it, the paper deems it proper to cover just about everything under the sun, thereby indicating its belief that connectedness makes the world go round. People, as I certainly do not have to tell any of you, go to great lengths and vast expenditures of money to learn how to relate to other people. They even study it in college. They touch, they feel, they look into one another's eyes. Yet the very same people, in ever-increasing numbers, are to be seen at work, at play, simply walking down the street with their ears plugged up and connected to a little box in their pockets, eyes rolling heavenward, fingers snapping. People with Walkmans, or perhaps I should say Walkmen, are people marching each to his own separate and solitary drummer. Try getting into even so elementary a form of relationship as to say, excuse me, but you are standing on my toe, to someone with a Walkman. Let me take just one more instance. And how does this strike you as a truly genuine case of something gone haywire somewhere? A number of years ago, a group of young, well-heeled American women, the best educated, healthiest, freest, and most benignly brought up women in the history of the world, startled everyone by announcing in no uncertain terms that they were the victims of intolerable oppression. Chief among their oppressors, of course, were their men, their fathers, professors, lovers, and husbands. It seems that these men were treating them in a manner they dubbed macho. Macho to them meant an excess of masculine ego and brutality. Macho men, the complaint ran, were keeping women on a pedestal, treating them like little dolls, and on the other hand, keeping them slaves and slapping them around. On one level, men were claiming for themselves the exclusive right to be powerful, to be breadwinners and competitors. On another level, men refused to be tender and were afraid to cry. The response of the men to this indictment, and following them, the response of all the institutions of the culture, was immediate and unmistakable. First resignation, then assent, and finally capitulation. With an almost astonishing alacrity, the men set out to mend their ways. They knocked down the pedestals, they began to shrink from the competition, and they commenced as well to duck out on the breadwinning. And as an earnest of their good intentions, they also began to cry. If whining and apologizing counts for crying, they cried a lot. Sometimes, indeed, when it came to such signs of tenderness, you couldn't tell the boys from the girls without a scorecard. Now, it may or may not amaze you to learn, the chief indictment of the young, educated, middle-class women against men is that they are wimps. Where one now hears women demanding on television and in newspapers interviews, where are the men? And think of it, all this wonderful revolutionary progress was accomplished in less than 20 years. One important aspect of this remarkably speedy accomplishment has been that most interesting and arguably most widely publicized of all our recent revolutions, the sexual revolution. Unlike many of the others, the sexual revolution appears to be a permanent and permanently evolving one. Originally, the sexual revolution meant that women were now free to have as much premarital and or extramarital sexual experience as men. It meant the lifting of the terrible old double standard. It also meant that women were to have the same sexual experience as men. They could pursue as well as be pursued. And for every male, pleasure. There had to be at least one female. In aid of this revolution, responsibility for contraception was shifted from men to women. Manuals of sexual performance proliferated. College dormitories became coeducational. Parental guidance on these matters was radically shifted. And above all, the popular culture fell completely into line. But no sooner had young women, in obedience to these revolutionary aims, begun to sleep around than they declared a counter-revolution. It was called Women's Lib. Liberation for women now meant not liberation to have sex, but liberation from sex. The original revolution, they said, so far from liberating them, had made them merely slaves to men's filthy lusts. If this latter sounds not like a new, but rather like the familiar old Victorian formulation, let me reassure you on one score at least. It was couched in far from Victorian language. One thing the revolution had irreversibly liberated for women was their tongues and pens. To make matters even more confusing, the move from revolution to counter-revolution took place so rapidly that most young girls were actually taking part in both at the same time. Simultaneously, they were jumping in and out of beds and being as hostile as possible about it. The result, not uncommon, I suppose, to revolutions, has been open and bloody warfare between men and women. No wonder they are marrying late and divorcing often. More recently, or so one reads in the papers, there is an even newer revolutionary turn in the war between the sexes. It appears that a whole cadre of young women have hit upon the most radical new discovery of all. They have found chastity. Next, who knows, they may even discover an even more arcane and even more radical principle called fidelity. When they do, you can bet that journalism and social science will herald the phenomenon as an unprecedented one. All of this might be funny, except, of course, it isn't funny because lives are at stake. So it must be said things are not exactly well with us. Consider the following two curiosities. Despite the new discovery on the part of revolutionary women in their late 20s and 30s that there is something to this chastity business, it does seem to be the case that sexual experience is now widely available to kids at an ever earlier age. I do not remember the statistics, but they are impressive. Rarely does one reach college nowadays, and even more rarely does one leave college nowadays without having had some and possibly a considerable amount of sex. Yet while this very development was taking place, the country was virtually being smothered in pornography. Now, if, as most people believe, pornography lives on and feeds on and is an expression of the repressed, how do we put together these two developments? American children were being freed to become sexually active in order that they should not have to suffer the diseases of repression that once so afflicted their elders. Yet a moment's glance at any newsstand or at the shelves of any videotape rental shop or late night television, especially in the city of Toronto, I noticed, would suggest that at least this disease of a persistently repressed sexuality, a need, a longing, a hunger for the dirty minded, is running ever more rampant. Or take the even more consequential problem of birth control and abortion. At a time when contraception has become both extremely effective and simple and easily available, in a certain number of American cities, abortions are each year outnumbering live births. Say what you will about abortion, that it is murder, or that it is no more than every woman's natural right. Even the most passionate pro-choice advocate will not maintain that abortion is the preferred method of birth control. Yet again, these two developments, a nearly perfected contraception and widespread abortion, have gone hand in hand. Each year, the experts produce whole libraries devoted to a dissection of the way we live now. But there has not been a single effort to explain to us how it is that sexual freedom and easy contraception should have come attended with so much pornography and so much abortion. I've cited these examples from the perhaps trivial to the deeply important, and they are by no means all the examples that could be cited. To underscore my point that there is something haywire with us, and whatever that something is, it is both real and serious. The truth is, we do live in very different circumstances from those of most of mankind, both throughout history behind us and throughout the rest of the world around us. But we are, as human beings, constituted no differently. Women, to take one of my own earlier examples, do not really wish to jump in and out of a wide variety of beds and do not thrive when they do so. Women do not thrive either when they live at war with men, nor do men when they are forced to live at war with women. The circumstances under which we live are not only different, they are unbelievably benign. We live longer, we are healthier. Most of us do not have to stand by helplessly as our children are being ravaged by disease and other disasters of nature. We are mobile. The whole world in all its variety and fascination is open to us. I will not even speak of our political privileges. In a room like this, that goes without saying. Still, we are troubled, and we are right to be troubled. It is not the fact of change that so troubles us. It is our belief in change. For in our daily affairs, we have come to conduct ourselves as if we were quite free to make up our own lives and make up our own rules. Each of us is a kind of walking Ford Foundation research grant to study an as yet uncompleted social experiment. last year in the New York Times, on this page I mentioned, the relationships page, there was actually a story about a class being held in some center or other to teach young mothers how to touch their babies. It being understood that the latest up-to-date research in these matters that babies seem to get along better if they are touched a good deal by their mothers, and therefore there was a class being held to teach, this is no joke, to teach young women how to fondle their infants. Each of these so-called revolutions being declared on our behalf carries the subliminal message that we are unlimited and infinitely malleable. We no longer assume the onerous burden of trying to teach our children how to live, pretending to ourselves to believe that in a technologically altered world, no one way to conduct oneself is better or more useful than any other. We carry on about threats to our health and well-being when we are healthier and better off than anyone, because we have in truth grown sick, sick from the denial that there are any limits on us. People, even the freest people on earth, cannot make their own rules and cannot make up their own lives. They cannot revolutionize themselves by fiat merely by declaring to one another that they have done so. We need to live in communities. We need to be affirmed and supported by others. We need to give ourselves to others. We need to accept the boundaries of our nature. We need to respect and build on the experience of the past. God knows it was hard earned. In the 1960s, our children confronted us, their parents, their teachers, their spiritual leaders, their political leaders. The children confronted us and said, we don't want the life you offer us. It's too boring and hard. It's too dangerous. It's too grown up. We want, as my five-year-old grandson would put it, we want another different one. And what did we, all of us, parents, teachers, ministers, rabbis, politicians, what did we say in reply? Suit yourselves, that's what we said, suit yourselves, and stood by prating about change and revolution, about new and different lifestyles, while our children grew pale and sickly and dirty, while they defecated literally on their schools, while they ran away and disappeared, while they poisoned themselves with drugs, while they again literally committed suicide in droves. Suit yourselves. Well, they couldn't suit themselves, and neither can any of us. We go nutty from the contradictions in our being if we even try. Thank you.